As British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson heads to the Caribbean, those hit hardest by Hurricane Irma have a message.
I want the world to know Turks and Caicos is not destroyed. We are open for business.
Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Anu Anand. Good morning. There are serious concerns about how Caribbean economies will recover from Irma. They rely on tourism, and the extent of the damage is becoming more daunting by the day. The BBC's Nick Bryant has made it to Turks and Caicos.
There were long queues at the airport this morning as it finally reopened and holidaymakers could get out. Survivors of the storm stranded here for days, desperate to get home. British holidaymakers face journeys of up to 24 hours as they island hopped out of the hurricane zone.
We were desperate to get out about 4 days ago, to be honest, so...
Finally you're leaving.
At last.
It's been emotional, it's been really hard, but yeah, we're survived, that's all what matters.
As tourists try to leave, another British military transport plane touched down. There are now 1,000 British military personnel assisting the relief effort in these Caribbean UK territories. But they're facing the question, why did they take so long to arrive? Lieutenant Colonel Tom Solberg is heading the team here.
As soon as the word came, we were out the door very quickly thereafter. It's just the physical distance, the separation. No, we got here pretty quickly, I'd say.
The beaches here are routinely judged to be amongst the most beautiful in the world, a bucket list location. But many of the luxury hotels are badly damaged, and they're the mainstay of the local economy. People need tourists to return.
I want the world to know Turks and Caicos is not destroyed. We are open for business. We are a fine destination. We're not destroyed. We have some damages. We're going to rebuild. We have rebuilt from Ike and Hannah. We're going to rebuild. We're going to come back. Turks and Caicos is open for business.
What's especially cruel is that the poorest communities here had only just rebuilt from the last hurricane. And that was 9 years ago.
The BBC's Nick Bryant. The markets this morning, Japan's Nikkei was up 89 points, or 0.45%. Despite new products, Apple is weighing on markets as shares of its suppliers struggled after later than expected shipping dates. In London, the FTSE 100 is down 41 points, or 0.57%.
Europe was battered and bruised by a year that shocked our very foundation.
That's European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker in his annual State of the EU speech this morning. Last year he was downbeat, but now he says he's confident the threat of Brexit can be contained. David Owen is the chief European economist at Jefferies. How much is this an effort to change the narrative?
I think he's right to say that the Eurozone and the EU more generally is certainly surprising on the upside. I mean, obviously the UK is leaving the EU, and obviously there's risks around that, huge risks. But we had a sort of sea change in sentiment following the French election results. The question now is how quickly they move to try and complete that project. They have an issue where, you know, Europe has underinvestment, has very weak productivity growth and ageing population, and those issues have to be addressed.
Given that the US and the UK have been turning more economically inwards. Is the EU going to be at the vanguard of free trade, open global trade?
Well, to be clear, I mean, the EU as it stands is the biggest free trade trading bloc globally and is much more open in terms of its trade linkages with countries outside the EU than, say, the US. But the priority really is to establish much more of a sort of true single market within the EU rather than establishing lots of trade relationships with countries dotted on the other side of the world. But at the end of the day, the EU is trying to step up to the plate. And it's obviously making a signal here that it's open for business and
Jefferies,
it's outward looking.
Jefferies' David Owen there. How many notes and coins are weighing down your pocket? In Sweden, the answer is increasingly zero. Last year, cash made up just 1% of all payments in krona there. Here's the BBC's Maddie Savage.
Hi, could I get a latte and a cinnamon bun, please?
Yeah, of course. And we only accept payment by card?
It's something you just get used to if you live in Sweden, where cash is completely banned at rising numbers of restaurants, museums, bars and shops. Victoria Nilsson's the store manager.
We wanted to minimise the risk for robberies. It goes quicker with the customers when they pay with the card. And also the whole process of dealing with money, having to count them in the stores and then having a company collect them for us.
Smaller retailers are jumping on the bandwagon too, thanks to homegrown technologies.
Consumers are very interested in new technologies, so we're quite early to adapt new technologies.
That's Niklas Arvidsson, a professor at Stockholm's Royal Institute of Technology.
Swedes tend to trust banks, who trust institutions, so people are not afraid to use the electronic payment services.
How long then until Sweden becomes a completely cashless society?
In the practical sense, I think 10 years from now, there's very little use of cash, even 2020.
But Sweden's rapid shift towards a cashless society isn't backed by everyone. I'm on my way to meet Björn Eriksson, a former police commissioner leading a national campaign to slow the trend.
I'm just angry because about 1 million people out of our 10 can't cope with cards. Secondly, this system could easily be disturbed or manipulated.
These issues mean that despite all the global chatter about Sweden becoming cashless, there's actually very little support for a change in the law that would stop cash being legal tender. A recent study found 2/3 of Swedes don't want to get rid of krona notes and coins, even if most can't remember the last time they used them.
Maddie Savage. Well, one person cash rich today is the Pitch Perfect star Rebel Wilson. An Australian court gave her $3.7 million, the country's largest defamation payout for things printed about her in magazines in 2015. The truth is, that's it from us. In London, I'm Anu Anand with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC.
This is APM, American Public Media.